Welcome to a very special episode of The Odyssey, a podcast by and about Mesa County Libraries. Today we'll be talking with two local experts on local lore, as well as mentioning some great online resources to get you in the spooky season. My name is Emmy.
My name is Bethany.
And we hope you enjoy today's episode.
Mwahaha! Thanks for tuning in, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this special Halloween episode. We hope that you're doing well and staying warm after that storm that we had this past weekend. The library was actually closed on Monday, so that was a little bit weird.
Yeah, but we're playing catch up, but it's fine.
Yeah, and we're ready for this Halloween episode to bring some happiness and joy, if that's your kind of thing. So today we've got Bob Silbernagle here with us. He is a local historian who writes for the Daily Sentinel occasionally, and he's going to tell us some local lore about Mesa County history to get us in the mood for Halloween. So welcome, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, we're very glad to have you here. And we've got Emmy here.
Of course.
Per usual. So, Bob, how did you get into Mesa County history?
Well, I worked for the Sentinel for a long time, just as a reporter and then an editor. But over the years, I also, as part of my reporting and part of my editing, I did some articles related to the history of the area, and it's always fascinated me. I've been into history since I was pretty young. So after I retired, I wanted to continue doing some history, and the Sentinels allowed me to keep doing those columns for them.
Very nice. And the story that you brought to us today is not one I had heard of, so I'm really excited to hear more about it from you. There is a newspaper article version of it, but Bob is going to tell us about it for all of our listeners. So let's start.
Well, in 1883, just 2 years after Grand Junction was established, Mesa County had a double murder. And the two murders were actually months apart, but they were directly related as part of a love triangle. And then there was a jail escape and a murder suspect who simply disappeared. And to add to it, there was also a sheriff who was either incompetent or corrupt, a judge with multiple conflicts of interest, and the sheriff and the judge were both Democrats who despised each other.
Sounds like a soap opera.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like a soap opera.
Western soap opera. Oh, that's hard to say.
Okay, so sometime in 1882, Henry Herrick and his wife, Maggie, moved onto a ranch at Canna Creek, just above where it flows into the Gunnison River. But Maggie didn't stick around long. She left Henry and moved to New Mexico. And then he filed for and obtained a divorce. And a woman named Margaret Thompson moved in with Henry. She was called his housekeeper. She had a 90-year-old daughter. But by July of 1883, she was also pregnant, presumably with Henry Herrick's child. Well, Maggie Herrick, down in New Mexico, somehow heard of the housekeeper and decided to come back to Mesa County to investigate. And on July 26, 1883, she rented a horse in Grand Junction and rode out to the ranch. And she met Henry Herrick and Margaret Thompson in a wagon on their way to Grand Junction. Then Maggie rode next to the wagon for a while, talking and haranguing her ex-husband all the time, not clear exactly how long. Then eventually she rode closer, and she shot Margaret through the chest, and Margaret died instantly.
Goodness. Can I just say I love that you could rent a horse
back then? It's like an Uber.
Yeah, yeah, right?
So Henry, who's driving the wagon, whips his horses up, and they gallop the wagon all the way to Grand Junction and take Margaret's body to Sheriff Martin Florida. Well, Mesa County had just been created as a separate county from Gunnison County earlier that year, and Florida was appointed as the first sheriff of Mesa County. Well, he arrested Maggie Herrick and put her in jail. She hired an attorney and got out on bail in mid-August. And things were then fairly quiet in this whole case until October. But in October 13, Maggie went to the ranch where Henry lived, where she used to live, with Sheriff Florida. and she was looking for cattle that she says belonged to her after the divorce. Well, Florido left her kind of at the boundary to the ranch to go look for the cattle by himself. And he warned her not to ride into the ranch alone, but of course she did exactly that. And she ran into her ex, Henry Herrick, who saw her and orders her to leave the ranch. They had some sort of argument, but she apparently agreed to leave, turned around to walk or ride away. We're not sure if she was on a horse then or not. And then Herrick blasts her in the back with a shotgun full of buckshot.
Oh, my gosh. That's karma.
Yeah. She didn't die instantly. She lived long enough to say something like, "You done me in, Henry," or "You killed me, Henry." But there were two young boys not too far away who heard the shot, and they went out and they found Sheriff Florida, and he came back to the ranch, but approaching cautiously. With his rifle out, he spots Henry Herrick, sneaks up, gets a drop on him, and Henry Herrick surrenders quietly. So Henry is taken to the Mesa County Jail to await trial. In November, the first election for Mesa County officials is held. Florida didn't seek re-election to his job, so November and December, he's a lame duck. In December, just before Christmas, Henry Herrick escaped from the jail. Apparently, he had an accomplice. He had horses waiting for him down by the river. And Florida, who was out the afternoon he escaped, didn't even check on him when he got back to the jail that evening. He didn't discover that Herrick was missing until the next morning.
Oh, no.
And the only newspaper in town then, the Grand Junction News, suggested that Florida was either incompetent or an accessory. It also described the county jail as one of the wonders of the world. It's a wonder criminals stay in as long as they do. Well, Florida did start a search and got on a train heading west, but he was convinced Herrick went southwest to Arizona, when in fact other reports said he was spotted near Ogden, Utah, within a day of his escape. But he wasn't caught, and in January, a grand jury was established in Grand Junction to investigate Florida. There were rumors that he accepted money from Herrick and other inmates to allow them to escape. And the Grand Junction News said then in January of 1884, whether it's corruption or carelessness, Florida has brought disgrace on the county and shame on himself. Meanwhile, we've got Mesa County Judge Robert Cobb, who is all over this. And like Florida, Cobb was appointed to his post when the county was created. But among other things, he was the one who granted the divorce to Henry Herrick from Maggie Herrick. But he served as Maggie's defense attorney while she was in jail on the murder charge.
Wow.
And he represented Maggie in the disputed cattle case. Then when Henry was arrested and Maggie's dead, he defended Henry on the murder charge.
Oh, gosh, make up your mind, dude.
Yeah, do you think there was just not enough lawyers around?
Yeah, I don't know. Just before Henry's escape, Judge Cobb approved the final proof of Henry Herrick's homestead claim. In addition, Cobb handled Maggie's probate, much to the dismay of her sister, who sued Judge Cobb and Martin Florida for false information on the missing cattle. Well, Cobb did seek to be elected to the post of judge in 1883, but he lost. Not surprisingly, the news wasn't very supportive of him. But he went into private practice in Grand Junction and stuck around for a while. Well, the search continued, sort of, for Henry Herrick, and ex-sheriff Florida offered a $300 reward for his capture or information leading to his arrest. The Mesa County Commissioners offered a $500 reward, but nothing ever turned up. And by the summer of 1886, 3 years after the first of the murders, both rewards were revoked. Herrick remained on the run, and he was never apprehended.
Wow. So if we've got any crime sleuths out there that...
unsolved mystery.
Yeah, want to search through the public records to see if they can find Henry Herrick.
I did do some searching. I found a couple of Henry Herricks, but...
no dice.
Not him.
Darn. How did you first hear about this story?
I believe it was actually from somebody at the museum that mentioned it. And then it was mentioned in one book about Grand Junction history as well.
Yeah, I see on your article that you said Wicked Western Slope was one of the books, and History and Business Directory of Mesa County, which yeah. just had the address and stuff. But we do have Wicked Western Slope here at the library if people are interested in learning more about nice. These type of stories. I also found it so interesting that there was just so many players in this story and that so many things went wrong that maybe could have been taken care of. Like if the divorce had maybe been handled better. Mm-hmm. What interested you so much about the story?
Well, you know, I tend to think of this time period, you know, 100 plus years ago. We call it the Victorian period. People are prudes, but not only was there divorce, but this housekeeper moves in with mm-hmm. Henry Herrick, and that wasn't that unusual. People moved in with members of the other opposite sex, sometimes got married, sometimes didn't. It wasn't nearly as prudish as I thought, I guess. And that's one of the things that this story brought home to me. And the other was that people do have tempers, but it's amazing that they would just shoot somebody in front of several witnesses. Mm-hmm. You know, first Maggie does it to Margaret Thompson, and then Henry Herrick does it to Maggie. And there were other killings in Mesa County before this, but they were more they were cattle rustlers mm-hmm. or rowdy cowboys that got drunk and shot each other, that kind of thing. This was the first romantic murder I yeah. could find.
Yeah. That's why I said it sounds so much like a soap opera. Like, first of all, you got basically two Maggies.
Yeah, right. Right.
The next woman you go with is the same name as your first wife. All right, buddy. But then, you know, dividing of assets at a divorce, like, you can't, I mean, yes, you can lose cattle, but if it was specified to you as something that you got, you know, when you split up those assets, I think you'd take a little bit more, like, you'd be more quick to get those mm-hmm. versus come back later and then have it out with your ex-spouse.
Yeah, just ride along the wagon and then shoot.
Man.
And, you know, I never found any reference to what happened to Margaret's 9-year-old daughter.
Her daughter, yeah, I totally forgot about that.
Yeah.
I can see why there was so much, like, speculation, like, there's information missing here, mm-hmm. and you're either not telling the whole truth or you're just completely out of it, like, come on, Florida. Like,
yeah. Together. It's like I just picture him sleeping with the hat over his yep. eyes, and then Henry reaches through and grabs the keys and just yeah. unlocks it, and no one's the wiser.
Yeah, you're not a Barney Fife, like, come on.
No.
Goodness.
Yeah, I'm kind of going to ask you to speculate. Where do you think Henry went? Do you think he went southwest, or do you think he went to Ogden, Utah?
Well, I think he went to Ogden, but Ogden was a big railroad town then, mm. and you could go different
anywhere,
places.
Yeah.
I think he probably headed west, like California, Oregon, Idaho, somewhere like that, and probably changed his name, and, you know, there were lots of, like, mining towns where you could get a job. Nobody was checking your references mm-hmm. or birth certificate or anything like that. Just if he was willing to keep working, he could probably continue doing that. Nothing ever turned up, but it sounded like he had somebody that helped him with the escape having horses. So you have to wonder whether he stayed in contact with somebody in Grand Junction after the escape. But if he did, he was careful about it, and nobody ever discovered who
yeah.
that was or how.
Yeah.
So my guess is he disappeared into a mining community under a different name.
That would make sense. And it was a lot easier back then to just assume a different persona
yes,
than maybe it would be now. So I was reading in your article that it says Margaret Thompson was buried in the Herrick Ranch, but that's been lost due to development. Do you think that the development of places like that makes us lose our history, or is it just an inevitable part of us expanding as a community?
You know, I think it's sort of an inevitable part of us expanding. I think there are iconic buildings and things that we need to protect, but we can't protect every bit of history, or we won't do anything. And I know that was an issue a number of years ago when there was an old house that some people wanted protected down near the Fifth Street Bridge on that.
That was the Crawford House, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
The founder of Grand Junction.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be nice if you could preserve those, but it's just, I don't think there's enough resources and you limit ability to do other things if you try and protect everything. But yeah, some of those iconic structures or locations, I think, should be preserved.
Yeah. And if you think about it, that's kind of what you're doing by writing these articles, is you're acting as a form of preservation of this material.
I hope so.
No, I was thinking the exact same thing. We've got these wonderfully written articles that are available in the archives at the library. We've got the Oral History Project, which is a great relationship with the museum. And
you also have a copy of my book, Historic Adventures on the Colorado Plateau.
Yeah, perfect.
Which is made sort of
a companion, maybe.
Well, it doesn't have this story, but it's basically a compilation of some of my earlier columns.
Yeah,
for this
awesome.
Memo.
That's awesome. Well, and I'm sure if it's not on the shelf for checkout, it's definitely available in the regional history room mm-hmm. for people to come check out. Like, there's little pockets of preservation everywhere. You just have to know the resources to find them. But yeah, without that preservation, like, we would just be surrounded by desecrated buildings that don't serve any function for society to progress.
Exactly. Well, Bob, I want to thank you so much for coming on and sharing this story with our listeners. I grew up here and I never heard of this story before, and I'm a total crime buff, so I was very excited to read this story. So thank you very much for sharing it with us, and we would be glad to have you back on in the future.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And I wanted to add one quote from the Grand Junction
Please.
News that I think is apropos for Halloween. In one of the stories, they said all those involved were ghoulish.
Oh, but well, and to piggyback off of that, you know, what's right after Halloween is elections. And knowing, just reading this story and hearing you tell it, like, just all of the ridiculous, like, you know, two Democrats hating each other and the fact that people were either, you know, not telling the whole truth or incompetent, like, do your research before you fill out your ballot.
That's true.
People you vote for.
Good segue. All right. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Bob.
Thank you very much.
This next segment, we have our famous in-house librarian, Ike, here to talk about a couple really spooky things that have happened in Grand Junction. Welcome, Ike.
Thank you.
Why don't you just Russian roulette it and start with whichever one you want, because they're all really good.
Yeah, a lot of them, I guess. I mean, we're coming up on Halloween, and, you know, there were some interesting stories that are, you know, kind of spooky, creepy. A lot of them, too. I mean, I was born and raised in Grand Junction, spent basically my whole adult life here, and I had never heard of it until I started digging in.
That's what I was telling Bob, because I hadn't heard of the story that he presented either. So it's very interesting to know that there's these stories out there that, being a resident and having grown up here, that I still don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very excited to hear your stories.
So the first one is just a little bit of, it's not necessarily a story, but it's a little bit of local lore. Back in the, it was mentioned in the newspaper in the 70s, and apparently there was an Indian maiden who would occasionally be seen up on the Grand Mesa, and specifically at Grand Mesa Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes right at dusk, you know, as the sun was setting, fishermen would see her walking across the water, and what was supposedly the deal was that this Indian maiden was looking for a lover who had drowned in the lake.
Whoa.
And so she would often be seen, as I mentioned, just as the sun was setting, things are getting a little bit darker, a little bit creepier, and fishermen would tend to see this maiden out on the water.
Whoa. I was just there a few weeks ago. If I would have known, I would have looked.
Were you up there in the evening?
No.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, right.
But I thought that was interesting. And like I said, I mean, growing up, we went fishing and camping up on the Mesa all the time. Mm-hmm. I never happened to see a maiden. However, definitely made it into some local urban mythology folklore.
Yeah, there's a professor that actually talks about it, right?
Mm-hmm. He gave a presentation at the museum.
Yeah, he was a former Mesa College professor back when it was Mesa College.
Wow.
Nice.
And the next one, so apparently in 1984, and possibly earlier than that, probably even later than that, there was a rash of, you know, paranormal, supernatural activity taking place in the Grand Valley. There was actually an article in the Sentinel with the headline "Ghosts in Junction," and apparently, all through town, there was suspected poltergeists, ghosts, other sorts of paranormal activity. In fact, there was a bookstore in Grand Junction called the Shambhala Bookstore, and they reported that usually on a weekly basis there would be 3 to 4 reports from customers coming into the store of those folks seeing apparitions, ghosts, you know, other creepy figures, things like that.
And it also mentioned in that article when I was looking at it about parapsychology, which is the study of paranormal psychology is what it's short for. And it was talking about how that they had talked to some professors of that, I think, and why maybe people were experiencing those things. So that's a fun internet hole to go into is parapsychology.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. And what I think, too, is this article from 1984, it wasn't just one little blurb, or it wasn't just one little mention on, you know, online about paranormal activity. There was a 2-page article written about these sightings.
Wow.
So I think that possibly lends a little bit of credence to this background.
Yes.
So speaking of book sales, our friends of the library are having some book sales coming up in the next month and a half or so. Tomorrow, Friday, October 30th from 9 to 2 at the First Congregational Church. Cash only, masks are required. And then beginning November 7th from 9 to 2, it's a Saturday. Every Saturday until the 5th of December, we're going to have book sales. So just a little plug right there. Back to some library stuff. Come get your books.
No ghosts are promised.
That's true. You might get a haunted book, but again, we can't guarantee that.
Exactly.
Okay, and what's the last one you have, Ike?
Okay, so the last one might be one of the more interesting, maybe creepy, I guess, depending on how you think about it. Apparently, there was a cave down there by Whitewater near the Gunnison River, just about 2 miles south of the Whitewater area. The cave was called Grand Boucher Cave. And in 1971, there were 3 brothers who went to that cave. Apparently, from the story, they were looking for Indian artifacts, you know, things like arrowheads or beads or possibly pottery. Doesn't mention that they found any Indian artifacts. However, they did find a casket in that cave. And the casket had, the coroner believed that it had been buried for 25 to 50 years beforehand. Inside of that casket, they actually found a child. And they thought the child was probably about, 3 to 5 years old.
Oh, my God.
They figured, the coroner figured that it was probably, it was not likely that it was built, or the casket was constructed before the 1900s, but that based on the cast iron handles, that it was at least 25 to 50 years old.
Wow.
Whoa.
Those boys were like, we just wanted an arrowhead.
Yeah.
We also have some library lore. We have a so-called ghost that lives in our elevator that I believe has been displaced since we've been working on the elevator. I don't know a lot about the ghost, but I do remember James, who's been on the podcast before, said that one day he came into the library when nobody was here because he had to pick something up, and he was downstairs in our adult learning center. And he hears the elevator door open. And so he was like, I thought I was the only one here. And he peeks his head around the corner, and it slowly closes, but nobody's around. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, okay, I'm just going to keep doing my stuff. And then all of a sudden he hears it open again and ding, and he looks out and no one's there. And so he grabs his stuff and he runs up the stairs really quick. So apparently there's a ghost in the library. And I'm convinced it's been displaced because of the elevator construction right now. So who knows? You could find this ghost somewhere in the library.
Well, and I never had, I never experienced anything like that happened to James, but I mean, I definitely had heard some sort of interesting sounds.
Yeah. Well, that elevator itself is creepy, but It would make sense. Also, I was thinking about another story that we had talked about previously about the Colorado Pear Company that was out in Fruita, and how that people used to say that was a portal to hell or something like that. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So before it was Copico, it was actually a mansion that a gentleman named Elmer Craven had built. And it was actually quite a sprawling estate. I graduated from Fruita Monument High School in 1998. I never personally went to the building, although I remember driving past it. And I remember it was sort of a local gathering spot for youth, you know, to hang out and whatnot. But yeah, there were definitely some stories about hidden rooms, places where they kept prisoners, maybe even heard references to it being like the house from hell, the hell house.
Yeah, and that was at like the height of the satanic panic too, wasn't it? So that makes sense. But interestingly, Copica coffee shop was named after that, right?
I believe, yeah, it was very much a reference. Yeah, and obviously we know Copica and Copico were very, very similar.
Yeah.
It's definitely a connection.
Yeah. Any other interesting stories you want to tell us, Ike?
There was also, in 1934, there was a trail building crew up on the Grand Mesa, and complete surprise, they actually unearthed a grave out there in the middle of nowhere. I mean, we know Grand Mesa, you'll find forests and meadows and all kinds of things, beautiful lakes, but to unearth a unmarked grave that's out there out in the middle of nowhere, no cemetery around, just a grave that's up there was pretty interesting.
That is interesting.
We all know it's a good idea to unearth graves, right? Can't go wrong.
Another local lore I was thinking of is the Grand Valley Curse for people that grow up here. For those who aren't familiar, correct me if I'm wrong, but you have to get dirt from the three mountains, right?
That's what I understand.
So Mount Garfield or the Book Cliffs, the Monument, and the Mesa. And it originated when settlers came and basically pushed out the Native American tribes, and a curse was put on any descendants of those settlers or anybody that grows up here, something like that. I can't exactly remember. And so in order to break that curse, which was basically that you have to stay in this valley for the rest of your life, you have to collect the dirt from those three mountains. And I'm pretty sure you have to wear it. I can't be sure.
I've heard a couple variations of it. You have to combine them all into a jar and store them either in your suitcase or in your closet whenever you relocate. And I actually had a friend, she didn't grow up here, but she got somewhat rooted here while she was in college. And then she got a job in Denver. She's like, I want to go, but I don't want to potentially get cursed to come back. So what she ended up doing actually was getting a tattoo. And she, of course, is an illustrator, so she was able to create the concept so beautifully. But she was able to depict, you know, those four monuments in a jar. That's and then so have, cool. like, the nice pen texture that looks like sand. So she's like, I ain't coming back. It's tattooed on my body.
I will say, I've left twice. Both times, I didn't do the dirt. Both times, I came back.
So maybe it's a legit thing.
Maybe. Self-fulfilling prophecy.
And I actually, I mean, I remember hearing about that in middle school. Yeah. So talking about like early 90s and in high school.
Yeah, it's been around for a while. Well, thank you, Ike. It's always a pleasure to have you on, and I really enjoyed your spooky stories. Where exactly did you find all of these stories?
That's a great question. So I use the Colorado Historic Newspaper Collection, and that's really great. You can go back, you know, it's represented across the entire state of Colorado. You can go back and browse by county, by publication, so you can specifically look through the Sentinel. And what's cool is that you can type in keywords. You can type in ghosts, UFOs, paranormal activity, poltergeist, and you're going to get results from those articles. And then you can actually view them and download them.
What I really like about that search function, we actually had somebody ask us a question via social media a couple months ago. They were looking for a news article about UFOs, but they had a date range. And so I was able to filter, and I said, I'm sorry, you know, nothing in this area or even in the state of Colorado did we publicize an article like that. But I was like, outside of these date ranges, I'm like, here's my search. Yeah. But she's like, nope, that's not what I'm looking for. So it's a really great tool, especially if you're not physically able to come to the library.
Mm-hmm. For sure. And another one that's actually, it's a product of Colorado Mesa University, but they put together a daily Sentinel index. And I found articles on that as well. And that works nice. It's the same thing where you can type in keywords, either a subject or a headline. And I found a few through that route as well. And what's nice is, you know, the Daily Sentinel is, they're adding more to the Colorado Historic Newspaper Collection. I think it's up to 1908 right now. Years that are past that, you can use our microfilm collection, which is downstairs at the Central Library, to access, you know, beyond that.
Yeah. And that one, unfortunately, doesn't have search terms on it. You actually have to look through it. So maybe use our online resources as a guide, and then
you can
look. Or if you have a lot of time, it is fun to look through those old newspapers. Mm-hmm. I used to do the obituary requests, and it's kind of interesting to go through those and see when fridges were like $2. Okay.
Well, we were talking with Bob a little bit about just the variety of resources that we have. And in addition to that, you know, when we're tearing down, you know, homesteads or, you know, potentially haunted buildings to make room for new things, like, there's something that has to go in order to progress. But we also have these fantastic ways of preserving history that are accessible. And as much as we are, you know, getting stuff online, you still kind of have to go out to the old microfilm machine and do some digging.
Yeah. And Information Services is a really great resource. The Information Services Department at the library, they can help you with the microfilm. Usually it's best to make an appointment if you're not sure how to use the microfilm, just so somebody actually is dedicated to helping you. But if you're familiar with microfilm, they can point you in the direction or help you search any one of those resources that Ike mentioned for what you're looking for.
You know, as you mentioned, Bethany, I mean, sometimes if it's a range, it can be hard to find some of those articles. However, you know, if there are certain historical topics, in the 70s, the Sentinel came out with they published a regular local history feature, and it came out every Sunday. So if you know of a topic, and if it comes up in that Daily Sentinel Index, you know, you may not have that exact page number, but it'll at least help find it a little bit, at least narrow it down.
Fun stuff. We have so many resources. I always get so excited talking about it.
And so many people within our organization that know so many things, Ike included.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know we've talked a lot about local lore and spooky things on this episode, but I do want to point people in the direction of Canopy. You're allowed to watch 10 free films a month. So, you know, if you're wanting to watch some spooky films before October 31st, there's a really great collection. My husband and I actually binged a couple of those shows and series last weekend, and they were really fun. So make sure you check that out, mcpld.canopy.com.
I will actually do a recommendation really quick since you brought up Canopy.
Yeah.
Amberlee, who's one of my coworkers, and I were talking the other day about Missing 411, which is all of the people that have gone missing in national parks. None of that information is kept by the national parks. Like, they don't keep track of who goes missing. And one of the documentaries that was produced is available on Canopy. And it talks about, I think the one I saw on Canopy is specifically about the children that have gone missing in national parks. There's several other ones. Like, there's one about hunters that have gone missing on national parks, but that's on Amazon, which you have to pay for. But I really recommend it. It goes into whether it could have been paranormal or whether there is a person out there perusing the national parks, taking children. Very interesting. And that's not local lore, but it is pretty spooky.
Yeah.
I will say, just as sort of another little mention of Canopy, that I mean, I'm a horror movie aficionado. And I will say, when I first checked out Canopy, I was like, wow, this is super legit. Everything from pretty well-known sort of mainstream horror movies to sort of like those B movies, maybe ones that are not as well-known. But I will say, in my opinion, it is very legit for that genre.
Yeah. And if you're listening and you have kids, you can get Canopy Kids. You can get unlimited movies for a month with Canopy Kids. So there's lots of good educational stuff on there, lots of good kid movies. But for adults, it is only 10 movies a month. and they don't roll over. So if you only watch 5 movies in September, you don't get 15 in October.
The great loophole about Canopy, I will say, and I haven't had to do this yet, but I made sure we could set it up. It's per card holder.
Mm.
So if you set up an account and your mom sets up an account and your husband sets up an account,
that's 30
that's,
movies.
That's a movie a night. You guys are ready to rock and roll.
Yeah, that's a good one. And you can stream it on your TV.
Exactly.
If you have a Roku, you can get the Canopy app. Stream it straight to your TV.
You can even stream it on your phone if you want. So anyway, fun stuff, you guys. Library. Come visit us online or in person. We've got spooky things all around.
Yeah, and if you have a spooky local lore story, even if you're not from Grand Junction, tell us about it on social media.
Yes.
We want to hear about it. I specifically want to hear about it. Because
just tag Bethany.
This is my stuff. So, yeah. Thanks for listening. And Ike, once again, thanks for coming on and telling us some great stories.
It's always a pleasure.